Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 20th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Ukraine. Zelensky calls on Putin to meet. By Jim Heinz, Dasha Litvinova, and Lori Hinant. Tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Baseless genocide claims hint at more than war. By Max Fisher. Omicron wave accounts for many more deaths than Delta. By the Associated Press. Alternative policing in Denver. A claim program expanding. After 20 months, STAR project to grow from 2 workers to over a dozen, from 1 van to 6. By Elise Schmelzer. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Ukraine. Zelensky calls on Putin to meet. By Jim Heinz, Dasha Litvinova, and Lori Hinant. The Associated Press. Byline, Moscow. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, facing a sharp spike in violence in and around territory held by Russian-backed rebels and increasingly dire warnings that Russia plans to invade, on Saturday called for Russian President Vladimir Putin to meet him and seek resolution to the crisis. I don't know what the president of the Russian Federation wants, so I am proposing a meeting, Zelensky said at the Munich Security Conference, where he also met with U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. Zelensky said Russia could pick the location for the talks. Ukraine will continue to follow only the diplomatic path for the sake of a peaceful settlement. There was no immediate response from the Kremlin. Zelensky spoke hours after separatist leaders in eastern Ukraine ordered a full military mobilization on Saturday, while Western leaders made increasingly dire warnings that a Russian invasion of its neighbor appeared imminent. In new signs of fear that a war could start within days, Germany and Austria told their citizens to leave Ukraine. German air carrier Lufthansa canceled flights to the capital, Kyiv, and to Odessa, a Black Sea port that could be a key target in an invasion. NATO's liaison office in Kyiv said it was relocating staffers to Brussels and to the western Ukraine city of Lviv. Meanwhile, top Ukrainian military officials came under a shelling attack during a tour of the front of the nearly 8-year separatist conflict in eastern Ukraine. The officials fled to a bomb shelter before hustling from the area. Violence in eastern Ukraine has spiked in recent days as Ukraine and the two regions held by the rebels each accused the other of escalation. Russia on Saturday said at least 2 shells fired from a government-held part of eastern Ukraine landed across the border. But Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba dismissed that claim as a fake statement. Sporadic violence has broken out for years along the line separating Ukrainian forces from the Russian-backed rebels. But the recent shelling and bombing spike could set off a full-scale war. The United States and many European countries have alleged for months that Russia, which has moved about 150,000 troops near the Ukrainian border, is trying to create pretext to invade. They are uncoiling and are now poised to strike, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Saturday during a visit to Lithuania. Harris opened her meeting with Zelensky by saying the world was at a decisive moment in history. Earlier Saturday, Denis Pushilin, the head of the pro-Russia separatist government in Ukraine's Donetsk region, cited an immediate threat of aggression from Ukrainian forces in his announcement. Ukrainian officials vehemently denied having plans to take rebel-controlled areas by force. I appeal to all the men in the Republic who can hold weapons to defend their families, their children, wives, mothers, Pushilin said. Together we will achieve the coveted victory that we all need. A similar statement followed from his counterpart in the Luhansk region. On Friday, the rebels began evacuating civilians to Russia with an announcement that appeared to be part of their and Moscow's efforts to paint Ukraine as the aggressor. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said the evacuation orders could be a tactic to provide the spark for a broader attack. To say it very clearly, Ukraine did not give any grounds for the evacuation that was ordered, she said. Those are the facts on the ground. We must not allow supposed reasons for war to be constructed out of hot air. U.S. President Joe Biden said late Friday that based on the latest American intelligence, he was now convinced that Russian President Vladimir Putin has decided to invade Ukraine and assault the capital. As of this moment, I'm convinced he's made the decision, Biden said. We have reason to believe that. He reiterated that the assault could occur in the coming days. Biden was briefed on Harris's meetings in Munich and has been getting regular updates on the Ukrainian situation, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said in a statement Saturday. Biden will discuss Ukraine during a meeting with his National Security Council on Sunday, she said. Meanwhile, Russia conducted massive nuclear drills Saturday. The Kremlin said Putin, who pledged to protect Russia's national interests against what it sees as encroaching Western threats, was watching the drills together with Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko from the Situation Room. Notably, the planned exercise involves a Crimea-based Black Sea Fleet. Russia annexed the Crimean Peninsula after seizing it from Ukraine in 2014. Underscoring the West's concerns, a U.S. defense official said an estimated 40% to 50% of the ground forces deployed in the vicinity of the Ukrainian border have moved into attack positions closer to the border. Tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Baseless genocide claims hint at more than war, by Max Fisher, The New York Times Company. Moscow, in another escalation toward a possible invasion of Ukraine, is issuing a growing drumbeat of accusations, all without evidence, that center on a single word. What is happening in the Donbas today is genocide, President Vladimir Putin of Russia said Tuesday, referring to Ukraine's east. Senior Russian officials and state media have since echoed Putin's use of genocide. Russian diplomats circulated a document to the United Nations Security Council accusing Ukraine of exterminating the civilian population in its east. On Friday, Russia-backed separatists, who control parts of Ukraine's east, claimed that Ukraine's military was about to attack and ordered women and children to evacuate. Extensive coverage on Russian state media portrayed Russian minorities as fleeing a tyrannical Ukrainian military, and President Joe Biden called such incidents ploys fabricated as pretext for a Russian invasion. The Kremlin has long asserted that Ukraine's government persecutes ethnic Russians and Russian-speaking citizens. The charge, backed by lurid and false tales of anti-Russian violence, served as justification in 2014 for Russia's annexation of Crimea and its invasion of eastern Ukraine. The recent resurgence of such language, and now voiced directly by Putin, indicates what analysts and Western governments say may again be a prelude to invasion. But invocations of genocide represent more than just a superficial casus belli. They reflect Moscow's sincere belief that in a world dominated by a hostile West, it is the rightful protector of Russian populations throughout the former Soviet republics. In that worldview, any break from Moscow's influence within its sphere constitutes an attack on the Russian people as a whole, particularly in Ukraine, which Putin considers effectively Russian. Claims of genocide, then, are a way to assert Russia's sovereignty through an ethnic Russian empire that extends well beyond its formal borders, and a right to control that empire with force. Clashes of civilizations. There's a long history of use and abuse of genocide rhetoric in post-Soviet countries, said Matthew Kupfer, an analyst based in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, who has studied Moscow's use of such claims. Since the Soviet Union fell, and with it the ideological basis of its constituent states, those countries have reorganized their identities around the memory of World War II. Genocide, as a symbol of the Nazis, became shorthand for anything deemed absolute evil, Kupfer said, making opposition to that evil a national imperative. In the turmoil of 1990s Russia, nationalist writers such as Sergei Glazyev won large audiences by calling Western policies an economic genocide against the Russian race. And when relations between Moscow and some of its former satellites broke down in the mid-2000s, charges of genocide became the language of confrontation. Pro-democracy uprisings in several former Soviet republics installed new governments, which championed their newly dominant non-Russian majorities. Ukraine's leaders, for instance, moved to elevate the Ukrainian language's official status starting in 2004 and to label a devastating famine in the 1930s as a deliberate Soviet campaign of genocide. Some Russian nationalists returned the charge, accusing those new governments of plotting to marginalize or even exterminate the Russian minorities within their borders. As Russian nationalists rose in influence, in 2012, Putin appointed Glazyev as a senior advisor on regional matters, a view took hold in Moscow that any threat to its influence over the former Soviet republics imperiled the Russian race as a whole. In 2014, Ukrainians again revolted, initially over their president's decision to reject a trade deal with the European Union in favor of one with Russia. The protests snowballed into demands to turn away from Russia and embrace a fully separate Ukrainian identity, which confirmed Moscow's worst fears of a threat to Russian influence. Kremlin allies again leveled accusations of genocide, at first mostly as a generic expression of condemnation. This became more than rhetorical as Moscow exploited Ukraine's demographic divisions, in which Russian speakers were, at first, wary of Kyiv's moves toward Europe. Russia invaded the mostly Russian region of Crimea and backed militants in Ukraine's mostly Russophone east, presenting itself as protecting populations to which it held a special responsibility. Sectarian division served Moscow's agenda, which meant that so did the specter of Ukrainian atrocities against the Russian minority. State media saturated Russian homes with false stories, including ones about mass graves filled with Russian minority civilians and a three-year-old boy crucified by Ukrainian forces that had retaken a separatist-held town. Russian citizens' support for Moscow's incursions surged. The Russian world. Putin, seizing on Moscow's successes, acting as protector of Russians in Ukraine, began energetically championing what he termed the Russian world. In his telling, it is a sphere of influence rooted in ethnicity, an ethnicity that faces continuing threats of genocide. This new mission solves several problems for Putin. It presents Russia's interventions in neighboring states, typically to weaken unfriendly governments or prop up friendly ones, as defensive. It tells Russian citizens who have suffered under 8 years of Western-led sanctions in retaliation for Russia's aggression toward Ukraine that they are sacrificing for an heroic struggle akin to World War II. It gives them a great empire to once more feel pride in. And, maybe most important, it provides an ideological justification for a government otherwise associated with corruption that offers citizens fewer rights or opportunities. An uncertain escalation. In December, with Russia's military beginning to build up on Ukraine's borders, Putin repeated a familiar justification, saying the situation in Ukraine's east looks like genocide. Claims of genocide of Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine have been a constant background hum on Russian state propaganda channels ever since, said Alexei Kovalev, a Russian journalist who heads a fact-checking organization. But unlike in 2014, Kovalev has written, Russians do not appear to be responding. There has been little of the past groundswell of outrage or sympathy. Russian views of Ukraine, once fiercely hostile, are 45% favorable and 43% negative, a recent poll found. Although Russians widely backed the 2014 invasions of Ukraine, they expressed little enthusiasm for another. Omicron wave accounts for many more U.S. deaths than Delta. The Omicron wave is breaking, but deaths, which lag cases by as much as several weeks, have surpassed the numbers from the Delta wave, and deaths are still increasing in much of the country. In 14 states, the average daily death toll is higher now than it was 2 weeks ago. They are Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, California, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Kentucky, Maine, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, and West Virginia. Since November 24th, when South Africa first reported the Omicron variant to the World Health Organization, the United States has confirmed more than 30,163,600 new infections and more than 154,750 new deaths. Although the U.S. did not identify any Omicron cases within its borders until December 1st, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has since confirmed that the variant was in the country at least a week earlier. By comparison, from August 1st to October 31st, a similar duration covering the worst of the Delta surge in the United States, the country confirmed 10,917,590 new infections and 132,616 new deaths. That makes the official case count about 176% higher during the Omicron wave than in the equivalent length Delta period. The true case count is higher still because, more so than during the Delta wave, many people have been using at-home tests whose results are not included in government statistics. The death toll during the Omicron wave is about 17% higher so far than the death toll in the Delta wave. On one hand, the gap between the increase in cases and the increase in deaths reflects Omicron's lower virulence compared with previous variants, as well as that Omicron is far more likely to cause breakthrough infections in vaccinated people, who are far less likely to die from it than unvaccinated people. Deaths also remain lower than in last winter's surge, before vaccines were widely available. 233,102 deaths were reported from November 24, 2020 to February 18, 2021, compared with 154,757 from November 24, 2021 to February 18, 2022. But the painful numbers, more than 150,000 Americans dead, underscore the country's continuing vulnerability. President Joe Biden said Friday he would extend the national emergency that was first declared in March 2020 in response to the pandemic. The additional authority had been set to expire March 1st. This is from the New York Times Company. Alternative policing in Denver. A claim program expanding. After 20 months, STAR project to grow from 2 workers to over a dozen, from 1 van to 6, by Lee Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Since June 2020, the mental health clinicians and paramedics working for Denver's Support Team Assisted Response Program have covered hundreds of miles in their white vans, responding to 911 calls instead of police officers. They've responded to reports of people experiencing psychotic breaks and people screaming for no apparent reason. They've helped a woman experiencing homelessness who couldn't find a place to change, so she undressed in an alley. They've helped suicidal people, schizophrenic people, people using drugs. They've handed out water and socks. They've helped connect people to shelter, food, and resources. The program, known as STAR, began 20 months ago with a single van and a two-person team. More than 2,700 calls later, STAR is getting ready to expand to 6 vans and more than a dozen workers. Growth the program's leaders hope will allow the teams to respond to more than 10,000 calls a year. The City Council on Monday voted unanimously to approve a $1.4 million contract with the Mental Health Center of Denver for the program's continuation and expansion. The contract means the program that aims to send unarmed health experts instead of police officers to certain emergency calls soon will have broader reach and more operational hours. These programs can and do work. You just have to work through the logistics and the buy-in, said Chris Richardson, Associate Director of Criminal Justice Services at the Mental Health Center of Denver. The city has expanded the program's budget rapidly, from the $208,141 in grant money spent to launch the six-month pilot project in June 2020 to the $3.9 million allotted in the 2022 budget. STAR is an example of a program that has worked for those it has had contact with, Councilwoman Robin Gneisch said Monday after the council approved the contract. It is minimizing unnecessary arrests and unnecessary costs, whether that be jail costs or emergency room costs. It has done so for less than 1% of the calls coming into the city that it might be eligible for. It matters that we're scaling it up. The program garnered national attention when it launched amid nationwide protests of George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police, although the program's creation had been years in the making. National news outlets such as NBC News, USA Today, and NPR reported on STAR. Politicians, community leaders, and police alike have praised the program. The widespread attention was a little unexpected, but made sense in the wake of Floyd's murder as communities demanded changes to policing, said Vinny Cervantes, director of Denver Alliance for Street Health Response. Floyd's killing prompted widespread conversations and critique of the nation's criminal legal system, which police and protesters have said is too often used to handle non-criminal problems such as mental health and addiction. STAR was kind of an answer for a lot of things people were asking for, Cervantes said. About a year after STAR launched, Aurora replicated the model, one of many cities in Colorado and beyond to find inspiration in Denver's new program. The program staff has been bombarded with requests for more information by officials and organizations across the country hoping to launch similar programs in their hometowns. I feel like the last year and a half has been a blur of all the cities and counties that have reached out to us, Richardson said. More expansion may be needed. Since its launch, STAR's paramedics and clinicians have responded to more than 2,700 calls, according to Carly Salion, STAR Operations Manager. STAR providers haven't called Denver Police for backup to any of their calls, she said. But those 2,700 calls are only a fraction of what STAR could have covered in that time if the program were larger. Salen said that there were approximately 11,000 calls to Denver Emergency Services that could have been handled by STAR in that time. The program's managers hope to scale the program up to 6 vans by April as part of the expansion allowed under the new contract. As of Thursday, 3 vans were providing services citywide from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day. Although the program was constrained to downtown Denver during its pilot, it has expanded to cover the whole city. Staff members will keep gathering data once all 6 vans hit the streets and evaluate whether more are needed. I think next year the conversation will be whether we need more, Richardson said. Demographic data from 759 people served from June 2020 to January 2022 show that about two-thirds of the people helped were experiencing homelessness. Nearly three-quarters of those people had diagnoses of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, anxiety, or major depression. Two-thirds of those contacted were men, and most people were between ages 31 and 60. About 42% of the people served were white, 22% were Black, 7% were Latino, and 11% identified as multiracial. Most of STAR's calls for service came through Denver 911, where dispatchers are trained to send the STAR van for appropriate needs. But about a third of calls are from Denver police officers who responded to a call and determined it would be better handled by STAR. Officers consistently ask when there are going to be more STAR vans, Salen said. Although the program began under the umbrella of the Denver Department of Public Safety, in January it was moved under the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment. It's the future of law enforcement, taking a public health view on public safety, Police Chief Paul Pazin said of the program in a 2020 interview. We want to meet people where they are and address those needs outside of the criminal justice system. Other cities considering. Cervantes also has received a flood of inquiries about the program from other organizations and city governments. Cervantes said he has spoken with government representatives of community organizations from Lakewood, Jefferson County, Wheat Ridge, Pueblo, Colorado Springs, and Fort Collins, among other communities, who are interested in learning more about STAR. The first thing we say to government leaders is, who are you speaking with in your community? He said. Aurora launched its program, the Aurora Mobile Response Team, on September 8th after hearing demands from protesters and seeing STAR's success in Denver, program manager Courtney Tassin said. The response team includes one clinician from the Aurora Mental Health Center and one paramedic from Falk Ambulance and operates from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday in the city's District 1, which covers the northwest corner of the city. In the first 4 months, the team responded to 190 calls, serving a broad variety of needs and people. We have people who are experiencing homelessness and people who are business executives we've been serving, Tassin said. Mental health doesn't discriminate. Aurora police on 50 occasions have called the team to incidents that they believed would be better served by AMRT, Tassin said. The main feedback we get is, when do we get more of you? She said. Aurora City Management already approved the continuation of the program through 2022, Tassin said. The team is talking with city leaders about possibly expanding, which Tassin thinks is necessary. People are in crisis in South Aurora, too, she said. Centering community leadership. STAR's launch and expansion have not been completely without tension. Some of the community organizations that brought the idea to the city and helped develop it have had to fight for continued inclusion in the program's future, said Cervantes, the director of Denver Alliance for Street Health Response. Several community organizations in April protested what they saw as the city's attempt to co-opt their work. We continue to struggle with the city to get a voice in the program we helped create, said Cervantes, who was one of the organizers involved in the earliest stages of brainstorming. The city in October organized a 15-member community advisory committee to help guide and oversee the program. The board, which Cervantes is a part of, meets once a month. We acknowledge and we accept the importance and need for community participation, STAR program manager Nakshan Zohari said. We wholeheartedly support that. Denver is also seeking neighborhood-based organizations to contract with the city to provide long-term support services to the people STAR workers contact. Not only will the programs help stabilize people in the long term, but they also will be another way to keep community voices in the STAR program, he said. You have the problem of the moment that expresses itself, but then you have underlying issues that oftentimes continue to be there, Zohari said. Anniversary of United Flight 328, Fallout, Searing Memories, Legal Cases, and Settlements by John Marie, The Denver Post. Kirby Clement's son was shoveling snow from the sidewalk in front of his Broomfield home this winter when he came across a small piece of light, honeycomb-like material. Clements recognized it immediately. The piece came from the interior paneling of an engine on a Boeing 777 wide-body airliner that exploded 1 year ago today over the northwest suburbs. shortly after the Hawaii-bound United Airlines flight took off from Denver International Airport. "We still find bits and pieces of that lying everywhere," said Clements, 68, whose home of nearly four decades served as one of the highest-profile landing spots for falling debris, namely a roughly 10-foot diameter engine ring that grazed his house and smashed the cab on his heavy-duty Dodge Ram 2500 pickup, parked in the driveway. Engine parts clobbered other structures nearby and rained down on a park where youth soccer teams were practicing. Nobody was hurt on board the plane or on the ground, but passengers and residents, including Clements and his wife Marianne, have dealt with emotional scars from the February 20th, 2021 event. United still faces legal claims and lawsuits by passengers, although it reached private settlements in recent months with 14 plaintiffs to end the highest profile case, a lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Denver. The airline also has dealt with insurance claims by Clements and others on the ground who sustained property damage. The National Transportation Safety Board has yet to issue a final report on the cause of the engine failure for Flight 328, which carried 239 passengers and crew members. But based on the NTSB's preliminary findings last March, which pointed to fractured fan blades, the Federal Aviation Administration in late December laid out proposed directives for intensive inspections and retrofits. Those gave United, the only U.S.-based carrier with affected planes, a path to returning 52 grounded 777s to the air soon. Jim Hall, a former NTSB chairman during the 1990s, who is now a consultant based in Chattanooga, Tennessee, characterized the incident as a very serious event. It rightfully prompted major responses by United and other carriers outside the United States, he said. But he questioned why two similar engine failures on Boeing 777s, starting with a 2018 Hawaii-bound plane flown by United, didn't prevent last year's incident from happening. "It was a miracle that no one was killed or injured in the event," Hall said. The FAA warned in December of the risks of not addressing the vulnerabilities at play. It said the next fan blade failure could lead to engine in-flight shutdown, impact damage to the tail assembly, fuselage, or window, with significantly increased aerodynamic drag causing fuel exhaustion or the inability to maintain altitude, which could result in loss of control of the airplane, a forced off-airport landing, an injury to passengers. Besides the 2018 United flight, a Japan Airlines flight in December 2020, about 2 months before the Denver area incident, experienced a similar failure. All three planes were older 777s with similar Pratt & Whitney engines. In the two earlier cases, cracked fan blades broke off and caused major damage to the engines. That appeared to have happened again over Denver. The NTSB's preliminary report indicated that one fatigued blade broke off and another fractured, consistent with an overload failure. But an official conclusion about the cause is still pending. United has said it got to work on inspections and some engine fixes last year in anticipation of the FAA's December directives, giving it a head start. It had grounded 24 777s that were in service at the time of the engine failure, with the remaining 28 in storage amid pandemic-reduced schedules. The planes are part of United's plans to restore more long-haul service this year. United has been working closely with Boeing, the FAA, and Pratt & Whitney to return those 777 aircraft to service, and we expect that to happen sometime in the first quarter, said Russell Carlton, a United spokesman in Denver. At least two dozen passengers have sued United. Although the planes were designed to stay airborne for hours with one of the two engines out, it makes for rough flying. Flight 328's pilots issued a mayday call, and silence took hold for much of the 20-minute return to DIA, as several passengers said they worried it might crash. Some took video out their windows of the right engine engulfed in flames, its cover completely gone. I can honestly say I thought we were going to die at one point because we started dropping altitude right after the explosion. Passenger David DeLucia, who lives in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, told the Denver Post after the landing. I grabbed my wife's hand and said, "We're done." The DeLucias were among 14 passengers who joined the federal lawsuit against United in Denver. It was filed by California attorney Jonathan Corbett and charged United with negligent infliction of emotional distress based on claims the airline failed to properly inspect and maintain its aircraft. The last remaining plaintiff, Chad Schnell, has settled with United, and the case was dismissed January 24th, according to court records. The terms of the settlements, including any compensation, were not disclosed. None of my clients are able to offer their own comment, Corbett wrote in response to the Post questions. And I cannot confirm or deny if this is due to an agreement with United. It's typical, though, for legal settlements to prohibit parties from commenting on a resolved case. Chicago attorney Richard F. Burke is representing passengers in about a dozen still pending cases filed against United in Cook County, where the airline is headquartered. He is a partner at the Clifford Law Offices, which has handled other airline industry cases, including litigation resulting from the crash of a new Boeing 737 MAX 8 in Ethiopia in 2019. Burke said this weekend's anniversary was a milestone some of his clients were bracing for because it rekindled unpleasant memories. These passengers, many different types of things can trigger flashbacks for them, he said. It can be a sight, it can be a sound, a fire, an alarm, a siren, things that can cause people to have some flashbacks, and that's what becomes problematic for them. There are things they can't anticipate and don't always know when they'll occur. It's unclear if more cases are out there. Asked about remaining lawsuits, Carlton, the United spokesman, said in an email, "We do not have anything to share regarding litigation." We were sitting maybe 10 feet away. On the ground, Clements spent most of the last year wrangling with United's insurance carrier to cover damage. He said his neighbor's roof, which was pierced by debris, sported a blue tarp for about 6 months. Clement said he hired an attorney after nearly 2 months of discussions with United's insurer resulted in lowball offers that wouldn't cover the roof and gutter repairs and the replacement of his totaled 15-year-old truck. Just before the incident, he had invested $7,000 in engine work for the truck, which the couple had used to tow a camper for summer excursions. He said he received a final property settlement in November, but hadn't bought a new truck yet because of skyrocketing prices for used and new vehicles. Still unresolved, Clement said, is a medical damages claim related to counseling and other mental health services in the last year. When he and his wife first heard the engine explosion overhead, he said they were relaxing on the living room couch on the Saturday afternoon. They're still rattled by that and what happened about 30 seconds later when the engine ring landed outside. It came just straight down, he said, and caught the edge of the house and the truck just instantaneously. And we were sitting, just like I said, maybe 10 feet away. As he stepped outside, he recalled, my immediate thought was, where is the rest of the airplane? You don't expect a piece that large to fall off an airplane and have the plane still in the air. As airlines look to return 777s with similar Pratt & Whitney engines to the skies, the FAA's airworthiness directives include conducting thermal imaging inspections of compressor blades, replacing blades suffering metal fatigue or other damage, and installing debris shields inside engines. About 150 older 777s were affected, with most operated by airlines based outside the United States. Hall, the former NTSB chairman, said that given the prior engine failures, he saw the Denver incident as one of the latest symptoms of the deterioration of FAA oversight over the past decade or so. Congressional investigators also concluded in recent years that lapses in the FAA's safety oversight during Boeing's development of the 737 MAX aircraft contributed to the conditions that resulted in fatal plane crashes in Indonesia in 2018 and the one in Ethiopia in 2019. Hall, in part, faults members of Congress who pushed the FAA to be more friendly to the industry. I think the FAA lost its way, and the primary mission of the FAA is safety, he said, adding that the new engine directives won't resolve the underlying problem. Essentially, the system itself became flawed over the last decade, Hall said, and it needs correction, as much as that engine needed correction. Denver Broncos. Will next owner try for a new stadium? Empower Field, not old, but not state-of-the-art either. History shows after sale, new facility push possible by Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. The Denver Broncos are officially for sale, set to command a record-breaking asking price estimated at $4 billion. While reports abound over who might purchase the team, the impending sale has prompted another inevitable question. Will the new owner push for a new stadium? Empower Field at Mile High is 21 years old, not exactly ancient history for football stadiums, but it puts the Broncos in the middle of the pack with respect to the rest of the league. 15 stadiums are older, 14 are newer. Given the facility's age, it's more likely for the next Broncos owner to explore potential upgrades to Empower Field over building an entirely new stadium, said Mark Gainis, a sports consultant who has worked with a host of NFL teams. That could include evaluating the stadium's infrastructure, taking stock of amenities fans may expect, and ensuring the team facilities remains first class. It depends on how good the bones are, Gainis said. If those are all good, a major renovation is more likely than a new stadium for at least the next 15 years or so. Last weekend's Super Bowl in Los Angeles put a spotlight on what the future of NFL stadiums could look like. SoFi Stadium, built in 2020 by Stan Kroenke, owner of Denver's Nuggets and Avalanche, cost a cool $5 billion, replete with more than 70,000 seats. Expandable to 100,000, a six-acre adjacent artificial lake, and a hanging video screen larger than the football field itself. The stadium is home to Los Angeles's recently transplanted teams, the Chargers and Super Bowl champion Rams. There are new owners who assume the post and immediately push for new digs to host their shiny new investment, but that's hardly a given, according to a review of past NFL sales, and should the Broncos' new owner want one, it could take several years before a new stadium becomes a reality. Of the 10 previous NFL team sales dating to 2000, six of the teams, Jacksonville, Cleveland, Baltimore, Miami, Carolina, and Buffalo, are still playing in the stadiums they called home at the time of the sale. Buffalo, 8 years after being purchased, is negotiating terms for a new stadium. For the remaining four teams on the list, the Falcons, Jets, Vikings, and Rams, it took an average of 11.5 years before the teams moved into a new stadium after their sale. So why do new owners want new stadiums? Fundamentally, it's the same as why old owners look for new stadiums. They want to make more money, generate more revenue, said Andrew Zimbalis, an economics professor at Smith College. The general phenomenon with new owners is that they come to the team with some aspirations that they can do better than previous ownerships. Owners, new and old, have been known to use a tried and true playbook to get cities and states to pony up money for their new stadiums. Fork over the cash, or we'll take the team to a city that will. Woody Johnson, soon after buying the New York Jets in 2000, floated the idea he might move the team to Los Angeles. 5 years after Robert Kraft bought the New England Patriots in 1994, he signed a tentative deal to move the team to Hartford after Connecticut offered him a $380 million stadium on the waterfront. He later backed out and kept the team in Foxborough, Massachusetts, after the state agreed to pay $70 million in infrastructure improvements. If this sounds familiar to Broncos fans, that's because it's a tactic former owner Pat Bowlen used more than two decades ago. Bowlen, who died in 2019, didn't explicitly threaten to move the hometown team in the late 90s, but indicated that he might have to sell to someone who would if Metro Denver voters didn't pass a tax to fund a new stadium. Bolin purchased the Broncos in 1984 from Edgar Kaiser, inheriting Mile High Stadium, where the team had played since its American Football League inception in 1960. But the legendary facility was getting old, and Bolin, by the mid-90s, believed it could no longer host a championship-contending squad. Of course, the Broncos haven't issued the threat yet, but it is implied, and it should be more apparent now than ever that these new owners, Bolin concluded, are prepared to follow the money in this high-stakes game of franchise free agency, Bob Cravit wrote in a 1995 Rocky Mountain News column. Like it or not, pro football owners do not build stadiums with their own money, not when somebody else will build one for them. Ultimately, the Broncos owner spent big money and hired a team of high-powered lobbyists to push a pro-stadium ballot measure over the goal line. 57% of voters across six metro counties in November 1998 said yes to a sales tax extension that would have taxpayers foot the bill for about $300 million of the $400 million 76,000-person stadium, later named Invesco Field at Mile High. Clearly, the vote was not a vote for the stadium, political consultant Jim Monahan told the Denver Post after the vote. The vote was a vote to keep the Broncos in Denver. The sales tax, an extension of one used to fund Coors Field, tacked 10 cents on every $100 from 2001 until it was paid off in 2012. Bolin obviously never moved the Broncos, but some owners follow through on their public musings. Kroenke threatened to relocate the Rams to Los Angeles from St. Louis, and then did it, even taking a $790 million hit, along with the NFL, to settle a lawsuit with the team's former home city. Owners in San Diego and Oakland, California, moved their teams from their cities after failing to come to terms on new stadiums. These new stadiums also are getting exceedingly expensive. In addition to SoFi's $5 billion price tag, the four most recent NFL venues to be built in Las Vegas, Atlanta, and Minneapolis all topped $1 billion. SoFi is an outlier in that it was financed privately through Los Angeles-provided tax breaks that could reach $100 million over time. Owners, politicians, and business leaders routinely argue that new stadiums will expand the city's economic impact, spur commercial real estate development, and create jobs. The construction of Coors Field, the Colorado Rockies baseball stadium, has been lauded as a catalyst that ignited lower downtown's renaissance. And one draw for building a new home for the Broncos would be to construct a dome stadium, which would provide the opportunity to host Super Bowls and NCAA Final Four games, which bring monstrous economic activity. But as Denver awaits a new owner, economists warn that paying for new facilities, especially with public money, has long been a boondoggle. Decades of academic studies consistently find no discernible positive relationship between sports facilities and local economic development, income growth, or job creation, authors of a Brookings Institution report wrote in 2016. Zimbalist, in a 1997 report for Brookings, found that no recent facility earned anything approaching a reasonable return on investment. Regardless of whether the unit of analysis is a local neighborhood, a city, or an entire metropolitan area, the economic benefits of sports facilities are de minimis, the authors wrote. In news briefs, Coloradan to lead correction system in South Dakota. Byline, Pure South Dakota. A Colorado woman who was president of a company that administers health care service to state and local corrections partners has been named to lead South Dakota's correctional system. Governor Kristi Noem Wednesday announced the appointment of Kelly Wasko as the new Secretary of Corrections effective March 7th. Wasco serves as the CEO of Correctional Health Partners in Denver. Prior to 2019, Wasco served as the Deputy Executive Director of the Colorado Department of Corrections. Former massage therapist takes plea deal in sexual assault case. Byline Boulder. A former massage therapist accused of sexually assaulting and groping clients has taken a plea deal and will serve prison time. Matthew Neil Mandel, 41, pleaded guilty in district court on Thursday to attempted first-degree assault and attempted unlawful sexual contact. Prosecutors dismissed charges of sexual assault and unlawful sexual contact. Attorney said the attempted assault count to which he pleaded guilty names one victim, while the attempted sexual contact charge names four women. Attorneys agreed Mandel will be sentenced to 6 years in the Colorado Department of Corrections. Sex offender accused of looking up child porn on store iPad takes plea deal. A registered sex offender accused of looking up child pornography on an AT&T store iPad shortly after his release from prison took a plea deal in his case and was sentenced to time served. Nathan Wood, 39, pleaded guilty Thursday in Boulder District Court to public indecency, a Class 1 misdemeanor. Boulder District Judge Norma Sierra sentenced Wood to 365 days in jail, but credited him with 365 days of time served. Sierra said Wood will have to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. Three shootings, one fatal, under investigation in Denver. Police in Denver were investigating three shootings Saturday. At 9:56 a.m. Saturday, police said a man was taken to a hospital with critical injuries from a shooting in the 1400 block of South Irving Street. At 4:15 p.m., police said the victim died. A man was shot in the 6900 block of East Chenango Avenue and taken to a hospital with injuries described as non-life-threatening, police said at 4:45 a.m. A victim in the area of West Colfax Avenue and Elliott Street went to a hospital on his own, police said, at 1:27 a.m. These are from staff and wire reports. Canada. Riot police in Ottawa clear Parliament Street. By Rob Gillies and Robert Bumstead. The Associated Press. Byline, Ottawa. Hundreds of police in riot gear swept through the streets of Canada's besieged capital Saturday, arresting or driving out protesters, towing away their trucks, and finally retaking control of the streets in front of the country's parliament buildings. With protesters in clear retreat in the largest police operation in the country's history, the end of the three-week protests against the country's COVID-19 restrictions and the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau appeared to be in sight. But even as things were growing calmer in Ottawa, the Canadian Border Agency warned that operations at a key truck crossing from Western Canada into the United States had been slowed by protesters, advising travelers to find a different route. The crossing near the town of Surrey remained open, officials said, but further details were not available. In Ottawa, Interim Police Chief Steve Bell said that although some smaller protests continued, this unlawful occupation is over. We will continue with our mission until it is complete. While some protesters vowed to stay on Ottawa streets, one prominent organizer told reporters they had decided to peacefully withdraw. We will simply regroup as a grassroots movement, Tom Razzo said at a news conference. Police have been brought in from across the country to help the operation, Bell said, adding that 170 people were arrested Friday and Saturday, and multiple investigations have been launched because of weapons seizures. We're not going anywhere until you have your streets back, he said at a news conference, vowing to go after protesters who don't disperse with financial sanctions and criminal charges. By early Saturday afternoon, protesters were gone from the street in front of Parliament Hill, the collection of government offices that includes the Parliament buildings, which had the heart of the protests. It had been occupied by protesters and their trucks since late last month, turning into a carnival on weekends. They are trying to push us all away, said one protester, Jeremy Glass of Sherbourne, Ontario, as authorities force the crowds to move farther from the Parliament buildings. The main camp is seized now. We're no longer in possession of it. Police said protesters remained aggressive and assaultive, and that pepper spray had been used to protect officers. Authorities also said children had been brought right to the police lines, saying that it was putting the children at risk. Canadian authorities also announced they had used emergency powers to seize 76 bank accounts connected to protesters, totaling about $2.5 million. On Saturday, they also closed a bridge into the nation's capital from Quebec to prevent a renewed influx of protesters. Around midday, protest organizers said they had ordered truckers to move away from Parliament Hill, decrying the police actions as abuses of power. To move the trucks will require time, organizers said in a statement. We hope that police will show judicious restraint. Police said one protester launched a gas canister and was arrested as they advanced. After $73 million settlement, Sandy Hook families zero in on gun marketing, by Dave Collins, The Associated Press. Byline, Hartford, Maryland. After agreeing to a $73 million lawsuit settlement with gunmaker Remington, the families of nine Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting victims say they are shifting their focus to ending firearms advertising with macho military themes that exploit young men's insecurities, all in the hopes of preventing more mass shootings. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.